March 9th, 1979, talking to Gladys Dart and Ruby.
Well, I guess a good place to begin is talking about where you were born.
Okay. Well, I was born about 60 miles from where Chuck was born. So we have similar backgrounds in a geographical sense. And the town that I was born in was called Moose Lake, Minnesota, although my home was in a small village called Outumba, and which is of Indian origin, and it means sweet little village. It was a town that had a logging industry as its main economic source of activity. And in 1918, that was 6 years before I was born, August 12th, 1924, there was a fire that, a forest fire started by the spark from a locomotive engine that completely destroyed the town. And it's one of the local legends of the area, the big fire of 1918. But as a result of that fire, it completely destroyed the logging industry. And then it became a farming community. And my father, when he immigrated from Finland, he came to Minnesota, and he married my mother, who was born in Virginia, Minnesota, and they lived on a farm first just outside of the town of Outumba, and then they sold that farm, and he moved into the town itself. And first of all, he built a hotel, which he sold, and then he was a Lutheran minister. He was a general store owner and operator. He was postmaster, and he was the depot custodian. That meant he met the trains, the mail, and handled the freight. And he had to do all of these things to take care of his family. They had 13 children. I was the seventh of those 13. And there were one child died in infancy. So there were three that, or one child that dying in infancy, the rest of them survived into adulthood. So they raised 12. And there are three older boys, three older girls, three younger boys, and three younger girls. And two six packs, right? And lost our first brother in the Second World War. And today we are still a family of 10 children. And my father is no longer living. My mother lives in the state of Washington now.
Well, when did your father, you said your father immigrated. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, when.
He emigrated when he was 17 years old. Let's see, on March 4th of this year, he would have been 87. So he emigrated from Finland 70 years ago then. And it was just one of those situations where restless youth looking for work in a world where the jobs were not to be found, and he looked toward America, and he came to America with another friend who was the same age as he was, and they both came to Minnesota and lived their lives there. He was a man of many interests, and of course his life reflected that. He had opportunities to move elsewhere, but he never left Minnesota. His heart was always there. This little town that we were raised in, for example, after the logging industry was destroyed, the farming community was there, but as the children grew up, there weren't the jobs there, so they would have to leave. And consequently, the population of the town steadily decreased. And there was a time probably about 15 years ago where my father and my mother were the only people in that town. So Altamba had a population of two. My mother sold the home that we were born and raised in. She'd had the home for 60 years when she sold it two summers ago. And she sold it to granddaughter and her family. So now Altamba is on the increase again. It has a population of five.
How do you spell Altamba?
It's Altamba, and it's capital Automba. There's a town, Altamwa, in Iowa, that those two are frequently confused. You've probably heard of Altamwa, huh?
Yeah. I heard that name, and I always pronounced it because the town that I heard of, I thought was
Uh-huh.
What were your parents' names?
My father's name was Matthew Anselm, that's capital A-N-S-E-L-M. And his name was, in Finnish, Riitijoki, which means reed river. But when he came to America, he dropped the Joki and just retained the Riiti and then anglicized the Riiti, and that became Reed. So my maiden name was Reed. And my mother, who was born in Virginia, Minnesota, her father was in mining. Her maiden name was Jarvis. In Finnish, it's also Järvenpää, which means river's head or source. And anglicized becomes Jarvis. So her name was Edna Sophia Jarvis. And I was born Edna Gladys Lorraine Reed.
Don't worry, we can write those names down in Finnish later, too.
Yeah.
I was wondering about language, too. Like when your father came to America, did he speak English or only Finnish? And did he ever talk about what it was like for him?
He spoke only Finnish, and it was a tremendous problem for him. There was also a prejudice against the Finnish people. I can remember him talking about working in the northern part of Minnesota while he was still a single man, and being ridiculed. And there was a Minnesota Indian who came to his rescue. He was a big, muscular man, this Indian. And he saved my father from a situation where he was going to be beaten. And this fellow became a lifelong friend of my father's. And I remember this Indian coming to visit my father right up until the time of his death, or a few years before his death, was the last time that I saw him. But
do you remember his name?
I don't remember his name, no. But my father also did have a problem. He talks about the problems that he had, not being able to speak English. But he also, at the time that he became postmaster, he said there had to, a special concession had to be made that authorized him to become postmaster because of his citizenship and his, probably his education, because he talks about having to learn, the way he learned the post office regulations and the postmaster's duties. He had the regulations in one place, English dictionary in another, and a Finnish dictionary in another. And he said it was a concentrated course in learning the English language. But we also were raised in a bilingual home when we were small for that same reason. And the rule was that we could talk only Finnish or English to, no, we could only talk Finnish when we talked to our father. He could only talk English to us, and my mother spoke both very well. So I was fortunate to be raised in that situation, because I learned the Finnish language well enough. So even after I came up here, I was never really fluent in an educated sense, but I knew the language well enough that after I've been here for 30 years with very little opportunity to communicate with in Finn, simply because there weren't other Finns to communicate with, just two or three times. When we made a trip back to Finland this summer, I was able to communicate with relatives who could only speak the Finnish language. So the influence of those early years was profound enough to carry it through.
So would you say that Finn is your first language, or did you learn English and Finn at the same time?
I learned it at the same time. So it was very definitely bilingual. It was a bilingual home.
How do you feel that that affected you? Because there's, you know, people say different things about, maybe confusing kids if they try and teach them two languages. I've heard that in villages, you know, people saying, well, I quit speaking Indian to my children because I thought it would confuse them. And they were also told that years ago in schools.
Well, I don't think this is true at all. I think I'm a richer person for it. I don't think a child is confused by different languages. I think the confusion arises when a totally new language is thrust upon them and they're forced to learn in it without and having to discard their first language, which has happened in many Alaskan villages. But I don't feel that it was a barrier, and I think it was a help to have been raised in a bilingual home. And Europeans can prove this, can't they, by knowing multi-languages and surviving beautifully? Right. You'll hear people from over there that, you know, get along well in seven languages. So I don't see where that's a problem. I would think it would be a help.
Mm-hmm. So when you said when you spoke to your father, the rule was that the children would speak in Finn and he would speak in English?
Yes.
So you helped teach each other?
Yes, and the point of it was by helping us, we were also helping him, because he needed it to survive economically. And you could tell that as he learned how to read, there were certain pronunciations that he had that would follow rules that he had learned to read the English language. Like, one example would be the word weapon. I remember him always using the word, pronouncing it weepen, and using phonetic rules for pronunciation of the word.
Well, you say that it was a bilingual home. Was it also a bicultural home? Did you feel that there was a difference in culture? For instance, questions like why people are here and how they should make their living and things like that, that would be different from Finnish customs. Was there enough difference that it felt it was a bicultural home as well?
It was bicultural in this sense that the Finnish have a very strong national spirit. And we were raised knowing about this strong national spirit. As far as Finnish customs, we were inhibited in my household by the fact that my father and mother converted to the Lutheran Church, and it was a church that contained many of the inhibitions about dancing, card playing, and of course any type of liquor was forbidden. But it was a very restricted household in that sense. Whereas other relatives, Finnish, that also immigrated from Finland that I later met when I went to the East Coast, they did have these customs of national dress and dances that I didn't have as a part of my childhood. But as far as national spirit and national loyalty that the Finns have very strong faith in, and also this whole business about the Finnish sisu was very much a part of my life. So in essence, I would say it was bicultural. I always felt that I was Finnish-American. And when people ask me what my background is today, my immediate answer is Finnish rather than Finnish-American. Because my my father's Finnish ancestry, of course, goes back hundreds of years in Finland. We don't really have the knowledge of my mother's, because my mother was born in America. I know that her ancestry was Finnish. She knew the Finnish language and was raised in a Finnish home as a youngster. But we don't can't trace her family background that far.
Do you feel that, or did your father feel that America welcomed him despite the fact that he was a foreigner?
I always thought that my father was still more loyal to Finland than he was America until the day of Pearl Harbor. And when I still remember that day very vividly in my mind, when my father rushed into the house, the only radio we had was at the store, and he had heard the news at the store, and he rushed into the house, and he talked about this terrible disaster that had fallen upon our nation at Pearl Harbor. And the Finns had been in this war with Russia in the early 40s that we had kept very close touch with as far as the international news on the radio was concerned. And I almost felt like we were almost directly involved with that war just because we had such a keen interest in it through my father. But from December 7th on, I knew that my father really considered America one, you know, despite the fact that he still was very much aware of what was going on in Finland, too. He was American first.
Well, did he feel that... he must have felt then that America welcomed him and that he was not excluded from things. Or did he feel that way?
I'm sure he did, and I know that he felt that America gave him the opportunity that he was looking for. He did have an opportunity when shortly after they were married, he had an opportunity to go back to Finland to receive an inheritance that was sizable, but it would have also meant that he would have had to remain in Finland. And my mother said that it wasn't difficult at all for them to make the choice to remain in America. So you know that he felt that he had found his place in America. And despite this incident of prejudice that I mentioned to you, just an indication of what no doubt was a very common thing among immigrants to the United States, my father always spoke about the opportunity that was there for anyone who wanted it. And we were raised with this attitude when we were small, and it was just a reflection of his own attitude.
So is there any kind of feeling that people in the family should try to retain their Finn identity?
No, it was, there was, I don't ever remember that we were talked to about it in any kind of a formal sense like you would have, but it was just in day-to-day living, we were exposed to it in the sense that he always remained actively interested in things that involved Finland. And the fact that the place where I was raised was a Finnish community had a lot to do with it, too. The town itself was almost exclusively people of Finnish ancestry. To the south of us, it was Polish. And you could almost make a line on the map that you could say the people on this side are Finnish and the people on that side are Polish. And but despite the fact that we lived together in this village, the Polish lived in, and we called it Polish country. Still, we used to get together socially. Of course, they were Catholic. The Finnish were Lutheran. So their lives were different from in the religious sense. Socially, there was contact and a very friendly feeling between them. But I suppose it would be similar to cities where you have, when I lived on the East Coast, there was a very definite Finnish sector there in Massachusetts, in Worcester, where I lived. And there was a very definite Italian sector, you know, in the town. I don't know how definite that is today, but it certainly was in the 40s, early 40s.
You talked about your dad changing his name, and I'm curious about what the reasons might have been, that he felt the reasons were for that, why he wanted to do it, and what the effects were.
I think the only reason he did it was because Ritiyoki, like, okay, if I told you, Kurt, I'm going to fill out this. Would you fill out this application for me? Okay, my name is Ilona Ritiyoki. Okay, the first thing you're going to do is ask me how to spell it, right? And in the it's hard to pronounce and it's hard to spell. Those probably were the two reasons why he decided to just simplify it. So I don't feel either that he felt any loss of identification, because in Finland there was the practice that if you bought a property, you took on the name of the previous owner. And so names didn't have the continuity that they have, you know, from son to son in our society.
You mean, for instance, if he sold property, someone who bought it might take on the name of Ryuyoki?
So if you ever bought the hot springs, your name would have become Dart.
So is that because, did the names generally reflect the place too? Like you mentioned, it had to do with the Reed River, is that what you said? Where?
Mm-hmm. So when we went back to Finland my last summer, there... one of the ancestors still maintains the farm house where my father was raised, the home where he was raised. And it's still just a magnificent home. It was a large home. On this land, there was a river. And the river was called Ritiyoki. That's where my father used to go swimming, and that's where we had the experience last summer of going for a swim in the same river that was the swimming hole that my father you had as a child.
Was that also his father's last name?
Before they moved there, his father's name was Herkola.
So people might change their name a couple times during their lifetime?
If they moved.
Huh.
More than that, if they would move to different properties. But of course, the population there is more stable too. That would present quite a problem in America with our transient population, right?
Well, the reason I bring it up is because in the early part of this century, and it's just about the same time probably this year, father immigrated, the people in Alaska were getting their names changed. And for the methods of simplification and to make it easier for people to call their names and stuff, people who didn't know the Indian or Eskimo words. And so I was just looking for a kind of a similarity there. That's just what I asked about.
But with many of the Alaskan people, they also only had one name, right?
Right.
So that would also complicate. It doesn't matter so much until you get a bureaucracy where you have to start keeping these things recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Then it presents a problem.
Right, and inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about the time you were born, when you were growing up, what your house might have been like. If you could describe the house and what kinds of activities went on there.
The My home, of course, was a very stable one because, like I said, all of the family were raised in the one home after this big fire. And the home that we were raised in was an old school at one time. And my father purchased the old school after the new one was built and just remodeled it into a home. In Finland, they have a vocational ed plays an important role in the public school system. So my father, by the time he graduated from high school, was an accomplished carpenter. He was a cabinet maker by the time he finished high school. So he did a lot of his own work, and he just was a man of many talents this way. All of the things that are required to maintain a home, he was able to do himself. And so we lived in this home. All of the time that I lived at home, and it was in, and still is in the family, but my mother sold it just a couple of years ago when it became too hard for her to maintain. And we had one of the customs that was very much part of our childhood, however, was the Finnish sauna. And was a log cabin on the corner of the back lot. And so we never had an indoor bathhouse. We had the sauna, which was ritually heated at least once a week, and of course, more often than that, as was required.
How would you describe what the sauna was like and what you would do, you know, to someone who had never been in a sauna?
Okay, it was a very well-built, small log cabin, and it was divided into two rooms. I would say that it was probably about 10 by 14, and there was the dressing room and then the sauna itself. And the dressing room just consisted of this open room with benches around its perimeter. And the sauna part itself was the most important thing was the stove, which my father built out of a barrel, a 50-gallon barrel, cutting the top open and then putting a shelf there so it could contain stones that he put on top of there. And then and of course this is when it's laying on its side. So the fire was built on the bottom and it heated the stones. Then you also had two metal containers for water that were right next to the stove, and the heat that would heat that water. And there were three platforms where you would sit. And of course, how hot you wanted it would depend upon where you sat. You usually started at a lower level, and then you quickly went to the highest one to get the full impact of the steam, and you got the steam by throwing water on top of those heated rocks. And the Finnish custom also was to take a group of birch limbs, the young tender ones, and wrap several of them together, and then you would pat yourself lightly with those, and that would quicken the sweating process. And you usually did this, worked until you were really sweating it out. And then you would go into the dressing room and just cool off. And you probably do this two or three times. And then after you've felt that you've done it enough times to for the perspiration really to do a thorough cleansing, then you would wash yourself off with the soap and water. And then after that, you would rinse yourself off, and progressively until it was a very cool rinse. And that's where you get the, which we did. You also heard of people jumping into the snow. We used to do that more for fun than, custom or practice. But in it also was a Finnish custom to do this. That's where you got your, after you had your bath, you would jump into the snow or jump into a cold lake water or so. But we just would do it with a progressive rinses. After I left home, in one of the remodeling jobs that my father did, he made a sauna as one of the rooms in the house. And when I did go back home, I rather missed that old cabin, because we did have the indoor one then. And rather than burn the wood, he had it oil heated. But that was, the sauna is almost the center of the life of a Finn. We noticed that in Europe, that the relative, which we stayed with a cousin and his family, they have several vacation houses, and we stayed in one of them. And each one of those houses, a sauna was part of the house itself.
So when you were growing up and you'd have the sauna, would all of the kids take the sauna together? Was it, a social event as well?
It wasn't communal, which it was. It did used to be in Finnish, but I suppose with Christianity, the inhibitions in that aspect segregated communal bathing. So it was pretty much by, it was always by sex.
So it was like all the girls would get together and have a sauna, and then all the boys would get together.
Yeah, very definitely. Yeah, and of course, especially with the strict Lutheran standards in my household, it would have been outrageous to have it otherwise. Fortunately, we're getting away from that these days, but that is still so intact with me that. I could not participate in communal bathing today. And although I can accept it very readily for anybody around me, I feel inhibited enough by the standards of my childhood that I would just feel uncomfortable about it, even though everything else tells me that it's the perfectly natural thing to do.
Well, more questions about the sauna then. What would it, to get just an idea of feelings, would you feel like before you started the sauna and in the middle and at the end when you get out?
You know, strangely enough, you would think that it would be a very exhausting experience, right? But when I can remember working either at a neighbor's or at a friend's or at home. In the summertime, haymaking was very much get-together time of activity. It was like potato picking time, you know, where you went from house to house. Some farmers did it alone, some got help. It was an activity that was a very exhausting physical type thing. But there were many things that children could do to help at this time. And I can remember many times being in that type of physical activity where you would have done a hard day's work. And you would take a sauna and you'd think that that would really knock you out. But actually, it wasn't. It wasn't an enervating experience at all. By the time you felt exhausted from the day's work, you took a sauna, and then you were ready to go and dance all night. And this actually happened to me later on. I can remember it as an experience when after I grew older and had reached that age.
So when you're in the sauna and you're up on the top shelf and you're it's real hot in there, what do you feel like then?
Well, you have to be very careful. If there would have been a stranger that would have come to the house and there would have been a bath going that night, you would tell them to be careful, because you have to know just how to regulate the heat to meet your needs. But and I don't ever remember being taught that, but it's just one of those things that you absorb and it becomes something that you recognize. You just recognize your capacity. I also had been away from the bath for a sauna for many years, and I had an opportunity to use one, and I was careless about it, and I can remember it really was an exhausting experience then, because I took too much heat too fast. And then it was bad. I can remember the first time that I took my husband, I said, let's go take a Finnish bath. They had one in Fairbanks. And I did the same thing to him. I threw the water on the rocks and he just got the force of the steam too fast. And he got, he just left the room and he became quite angry with me. And he said, Toby, you crazy Finns, even the Russians had enough sense to keep their heads out of the tents. But I just, in my enthusiasm, wasn't being considerate enough. And it also has a lot to do with your general health. Like, there have been periods in my life when Chuck has tolerates a bath much to a much greater degree than I do. For example, if you've had a major surgery or something like this, then you would really have to watch it. Or if you've been sick.
How hot would it get in these sauna?
I imagine there are times when it gets over 200 degrees. But that's quite different, because you're getting it's hot air. You know, and what you do, you take, like it's difficult breathing, but you just take a washcloth and put it in cold water and you put it across your mouth, and you can, so it makes the breathing easier. But it isn't like the hot springs, you know, which at 115, you tread in there quickly and come out fast, you know, even faster. But you're immersed in the hot water there. But in a sauna, it's different, because it's the hot air.
Yeah. Did you have both dry and steam saunas? People talk about a difference that way.
I don't know what you mean by a dry one, because a sauna is a steam bath, you know. But you regulate the steam by the amount of water you throw on it. Where did you hear about dry baths?
People would talk about a dry sauna, and that would, they would get the temperature much higher. They wouldn't use much steam. And then some things, maybe it's not even like a finished sauna, maybe it's like a Turkish steam bath or something. There's just a lot of steam in the air all the time. And they wouldn't get it as hot because the air was cold. Let's see. Well, any other questions?
Now, that's another thing that, how much the sauna is a part of the Finnish way of life. When we went to Finland, we were shown the sauna that my father was born in. The women, when they gave birth to a child, did it in the sauna rather than in the bedroom of the house. And it was a custom there at that time. It isn't anymore.
Do they have a reason for that?
I don't know, probably just the fact, I'm just presuming now, but